So Marcus has been coming in and doing handy practical things around the house. You've probably noticed the downstairs loo's had another coat of paint on it. And next week he's going to be tightening up the lectern. but it just gives me an opportunity to tell the Mahasattva Foo story, which some of you will know, but some of you won't. So this is one of the cases, one of the case studies in the Blue Cliff Record. So the Blue Cliff Record is a collection, is a Zen collection. And like a great many Zen texts, it is deeply inscrutable, deeply, deeply bizarre. It has two levels of commentary, each of which is even more confusing than the original text. Or it is for me, anyway. It might be that you were to pick it up and have some glorious insight to it. And cases is a literal translation of the term Kung An, I believe, which is what became koan in Japanese. So in Japanese Zen, you're familiar with the koan, these questions that aren't soluble on their own terms, these sort of great spiritual sort of crises, in a way. They create a spiritual crisis by putting all of your energy into trying to resolve a query that isn't soluble on its own terms. But one case is, I think this is case 77, is the case of Mahasattva Foo expounds the Diamond Sutra. So the Diamond Sutra is one of the perfection of wisdom texts, and that's a cheesy, almost a link to this evening's talk, but I'm just as an excuse to tell a story. Partly because April wanted a story, so you deserve a story, don't you, April? And Mahasattva Foo lives up in the mountains. He's a hermit in China. Mahasattva means great being. Yeah, so he's he's an enlightened master. He lives a hermit's life up in the mountains, and he just comes out in the mountains occasionally to get firewood or to gather some alms or something like that. And he comes down from the mountains to collect firewood, as it happens, on this occasion. And the emperor hears that Mahasattva Foo is in town and instructs his guards to go and get Mahasattva Foo, to come and give him a Dharma teaching. So when the emperor sends an invitation like that, you don't have an option to say, sorry, I'm just getting some wood and I'm going back up to the mountains. You come or you die. It's as simple as that. So Mahasattva Foo, you can imagine, he's a little old man, lives in the mountains. You can imagine the finery of the Chinese court. I'm afraid I don't know the dates, but you've seen those big, what are those movies with Tom Cruise? They've all got Tom Cruise in, haven't they? All those movies. The incredible pomp of the Chinese court. And of course the king has his own Buddhist teachers, his own abbots. And Mahasattva Foo comes in, and Mahasattva Foo is to expound the Diamond Sutra, yeah, the perfection of wisdom teaching which cuts like a diamond. And Mahasattva Foo comes in, glares at everybody, grabs the lectern and goes, excuse me, turns around and walks out. He just rattles the lectern. That's for the tape, in case it wasn't obvious on the tape that that was what was going on there. And so the emperor's just kind of, you can imagine the court's just kind of like, mad old man, what is all that about? And so the emperor turns to the chief abbot and says to him, what is the meaning of this? What is it? I asked Mahasattva Foo to come and expound the Diamond Sutra, and all he's come in is just rattled his lectern at me. And the abbot says, Mahasattva Foo has perfectly expounded the Diamond Sutra. Mm-hmm. So, there you go. It's all just a bit of an aside because we've got a bit of a rattly lectern. But we start with another story, or at least another sort of scene. And perhaps you can imagine this in a movie. Perhaps you can remember this from your own teenage years. Or you've read it in a book. And you can imagine a young couple, yeah? a boy and a girl, teenage boy and a teenage girl, and they're canoodling, shall we say. Perhaps they're at the movies, perhaps they're in the back seat of the car, perhaps they're on the sofa, who knows, who knows. Use your own imagination, but don't get carried away, remember we're in the shrine room, okay? And at a certain point, she pulls back a little and she says, "Do you love me?" And what do you think the boy says in response? Well, he probably does, in most of these situations, is he looks a bit confused, or perhaps a little sort of, oh dear, what am I meant to say here? And he says something like, "Well, it depends what you mean by love, doesn't it?" Yeah, does this sound familiar, at least in a clichéd way? Perhaps it sounds familiar from your own life, but you'll be familiar with it.
Say yes.
It depends whether you're up to at that point, doesn't it? It depends when the question gets asked, I think. And yeah, it's a rather cliched little exchange, but it is with a basis. Teenage boys are often a little emotionally clueless. Sometimes teenage girls are a little overwhelmed by the intensity of their emotions, lose a bit of perspective through that. But what do we mean by love? In fact, what do we mean by any word at all? What do we mean by words? I've been reading, over the course of this year, I've been gradually working my way through a book called Confessions of a Philosopher by a chap called McGee, which is surprisingly engaging and interesting, actually, and quite dharmic. He sort of seems to have quite a naturally dharmic perspective on things. And he has a rather scathing attitude to British philosophy in the 20th century, which seems quite entirely well-founded to me. Because what happened with British philosophy in the 20th century is they went up this cul-de-sac, getting completely obsessed with trying to define the meaning of words, thinking that philosophy isn't about understanding the meaning of life, isn't about how to live a more fully whole life, isn't about the love of the truth, yeah, but about the definition of words. What we mean when we say certain things. Which, in a way, you don't have to think very hard about this for this to be a rather silly objective. I mean, I'm going to quote a couple of philosophers, in very inaccurately and in very small detail. But somebody who they based a lot of their thought on was a chap called Wittgenstein, and Wittgenstein, they based a lot of their stuff on him completely erroneously, because what he'd said was that, yeah, we can clarify to some extent what we mean by words, but actually, even if we're able to achieve that, we achieve next to nothing, because the really important things in life, you can't say anything about. You have to remain silent, in a way, on the really important things in life. Which is a reflection of a Buddhist truth, really, a truth observed by Buddhism right the way through. The most famous incident is in the Vimalakirti Nidesha. So Vimalakirti, some of you again will know this story, some of you it'll be a new one. Vimalakirti is a lay bodhisattva. He's a householder, but he's an incredibly accomplished bodhisattva. And there's a long sutra. At the start of the sutra, Vimalakirti is poorly. He's not very well. And the Buddha is trying to encourage various bodhisattvas in turn to go and his disciples, various of his disciples, to go and visit Vimalakirti and see how he's getting on. Actually, Vimalakirti isn't really ill. It's a skillful means. He's just pretending to be ill. But that's another story. And what happens is, in turn, each of his disciples and bodhisattvas sort of say, "Oh, I'm frightened of going to see Vimalakirti because he proved out that I didn't really understand the Dharma properly." There's this sort of sequence of little stories about how Vimalakirti sort of shown each of them up in turn. And the most famous exchanges, and what happens is eventually Manjushri, the bodhisattva of wisdom, agrees that he'll go round to see how Vimalakirti is. And they engage in this discussion about the nature of reality, in a way. Which Manjushri says something, and then Vimalakirti says something more accurate and more profound each time. And Vimalakirti's trump card, as it were, at the end, after Manjushri said this very... I should have looked this up, shouldn't I? I should have quoted it more fully. This incredibly sort of precise and accurate thing about the nature of reality. Vimalakirti's response is a thunderous silence. by which, you know, by which he communicates reality much more fully than anything that can be said. So in a way, yeah, we can define words, but you can only define words with other words, and then those words need defining, and then you've got a choice. You either use the first words that you already had, which just ties you up in a circle and doesn't tell you anything, or you just end up with this eternal regression of you define a word with another word, and then you have to define that word with more words, and then you have to define those words with more words, and you just end up going completely barking. So we can't pin down words fully. And in the same way, they can't really do our experience justice. Words are very limited. We have to use them, but we really have to be sensitive to their imprecision, to their limitations. This is my other slightly pretentious philosopher quote. Jacques Derrida, who died last year, he said a lot of things that were very confusing. But one thing he said quite early on, which I think is quite a Buddhist thing to say, actually, I find a very useful little observation. He says somewhere that all naming is a violence. All naming is a violence. So what I take him to mean by that is that you can describe things in a way. But just imagine an orange. Yeah? Imagine I'm holding an orange here in my hand. So you could describe that orange. You could say, it's orange. It's got dimples. You know, things like that. But anything you said about that orange would fall short, wouldn't it? There's nothing that you could say that could really encapsulate or communicate the experience of looking at an orange, let alone the experience of tasting an orange. Yeah? So, I quite like this. All naming is a violence. It's a bit like Procrustes. Let's bring in another reference. So Procrustes was a robber, isn't he, in Greek mythology? And what he would do, Procrustes had this bed, and what you had to do was you had to fit, when Procrustes got you, you had to fit in his bed. You had to be the right size for his bed, and if you were too long for his bed, bits of you got chopped off, and if you were too short for his bed, you got stretched till you fitted. Yeah. So words are a bit like that, aren't they? Words, you have to chop off the ends of your experience, as it were, or stretch your experience somehow to try and get the words to fit properly. Is this making sense to people? Is this kind of... Okay, good. So that's what I understand by Derrida's phrase about all naming is a violence.